morning, Lucy.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowell Full Year 2017 Investor Webcast. My name is Courtney, and I'll be your coordinator for today's event. For the duration of the call, you will be on listen only. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions. If you need assistance at any time, please press star zero on your telephone keypad, and you will be connected to an operator. I will now hand you over to your host, Colin Storer, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Courtney. Welcome and good morning, everyone. My name is Colin Storer. I'm the CFO of Garfunkel Fourth Quarter Two, and I'd like to extend a really warm welcome to you all today as you join us for a review of our full year 2017 results. It's a set of results we're pleased to present as we reflect on what's been a key year in Lowell's history, complemented by a further period of strong trading. Given today's call covers our year-end numbers, I'm pleased to be joined by John Truss, our Head of IR, Matthias Gerhardt, our Director of Corporate Development, and of course our Group CEO, James Cornell. James will once again set the financials in a strategic context way better than I could possibly dream of. So, outside of that introduction, there are three key messages we would like you to take away today. Firstly, looking back over the last 12 months and reflecting on our financial performance, the group has delivered another strong set of results. Impressive growth is once again apparent, something all the more impressive given our ever greater size. Secondly, in terms of today, we appreciate we've recently experienced something of a coming of age. The acquisition of the interim carve-out represents a key moment in our corporate maturity, providing us with both further scale and further diversification. And finally, looking forward, we want to share our excitement as to the prospects of the business. We're now a European leader, with leading platforms in the largest recurring CMS markets, in an environment we believe to be highly conducive for growth. Our strategy remains consistent, and we very much look forward to delivering that growth I've just alluded to. As with our Q3 17 results call, we're sharing our presentation via webcast. If you've not done so already and wish to refer to the presentation after the call, both this document and, of course, the important statutory financial statements are available to download at any time from our investor relations website, which I'll try and get right this time, is www.lowellgroup.com. Turning now to the presentation itself and the key housekeeping points on slide three. Now, I admit this is a dry opening, but it is important to provide appropriate context at the outset, given we're going to cover two different dynamics within this particular year-end presentation. Firstly, we're going to be talking through our 2017 historic performance, which captures the consolidated trading results of the Garfunkel's Hall Court 2 entity. So for ease, we refer to this entity as Lowell. And in this presentation, it's also sometimes denoted to as the extant group. We present key cash metrics, some of which are non-IFRS measures, as we believe they enhance an investor's understanding of the group's cash flow generation. Alongside this, we provide insight in terms of how these metrics reconcile to the reported and audited revenue and operating profit as per our IFRS statutory accounts. The second dynamic which we have to talk through is that we also need to present a pro forma position following our acquisition of the carve-out business from Intrum. This is in order to illustrate the shape and size of our much enlarged, much improved business going forward. And one last point I'd like to make as CFO before I hand over to James. We do appreciate that as a key player in the industry, we've got an obligation to provide thought leadership on important reporting topics. And in keeping with this, we sought today to provide further insight and transparency on various subjects within our results presentation. We've included more granular analysis as to our gross money multiples, more information as to our cost to collect ratios, and clearer presentation of our segmental gross profit margins alongside a further breakdown of our regional results. Whilst this will lead to a slightly longer call than usual, we do believe it worthwhile to help people better understand what a fantastic business we're representing today.
Morning, everyone. First of all, I just want to say that we do recognise the backdrop against which we deliver our year-end results. Whilst we believe the strength of our business speaks for itself, some of our bonds, the same as some of our peers, have traded down in recent months, whilst the CDS on our unsecured instrument has increased. During this period, we have given thought as to how best to support our bondholders. We believe that in addition to improved disclosure and proactive investor relations, the best thing we can continue to do is continue to deliver on robust results and actions in keeping with our strategy. And that is what we believe we're in a position to be able to do today. So, let me start by talking through slide 6. We've already shared this slide many times during the last year as it helps you understand what we focus upon. Our strategic focus is around the achievement of growth, diversification, innovation, and consumer centricity. It is only through the pursuit and the development of these drivers that we further improve the financial well-being of our clients, our consumers, and our creditors. This matters. And to us, it's important that we do it really well. In light of these ambitions, I'm pleased to be able to step back and characterize 2017 as another year of continued success. On the 20th of March, 2018, we completed the transformational acquisition of the carve-out business from Intrum. This transaction solidifies our position as a preeminent player in the European CMS space and provides us with a position of market leadership in the Nordic region, particularly within financial services. The acquisition further adds to the strength of our diversification and the sophistication of our scale and our data insight. Today, we are more diversified than ever before in terms of product mix, regions, clients we serve, and the sectors we serve and deploy capital into. Today, we have more data than ever before, with more than 3,100 owned portfolios and more than £13 billion of 3PC assets under management. The combination of our scale, both the breadth and depth of it, together with our drive to innovate in the pursuit of enhanced collections effectiveness, is what underpins our unblemished track record of growth and improvement. In addition, our consumer focus and the consistency of such an approach across the whole of Laos provides sustained confidence in the robustness of our collections model and thus its earnings. And we believe we benefit from the most resilient and most sustainable collections model in Europe, with our historical collections profile a source of pride throughout the organization. Suffice to say, the successful delivery of our strategy is reflected in the extant group's financial performance as captured on slide 7. In 2017, we have once again delivered double-digit growth across the vast majority of our key financial metrics. Colin will, of course, bring more colour to the drivers of our financials, but I'm personally really pleased that in what has been a pivotal and transformational year for the business, we have continued to achieve healthy growth whilst better positioning the group for the future. We are achieving success in terms of our balance sheet metrics, our new business metrics, our cash measures, our profitability, and our funding goals.
If I can ask you to move on to section 2, I'd like to talk you through the 2017 results of the Extant Group first. So if I start with slide 9, you'll see we've once again delivered impressive income growth, with cash income up 22% year on year. In order to provide greater reporting insight, on the left-hand side of the slide, we've included a bridge from the revenue reported within the IFRS statutory accounts to our disclosed cash income. We're equally pleased that the growth in cash income has been achieved across both our regions and both our service lines, as you can see on the right-hand side of the slide. We consciously seek to report cash income given our primary audience on this call are our providers of funding, as it's a cash measure that allows the reader to understand collections on assets owned and fees and commissions earned from our servicing activities. The ongoing reporting of cash metrics remains fundamental to understanding and interpreting the underlying performance of our business. If I move to slide 10 and provide some insight for the first time as to the Extant Group segmental gross profit and gross profit margins. We define gross profit as cash income less normalized collection activity costs. In other words, after adjusting for non-cash impairment of non-performing loans and non-recurring costs and exceptional items, net of exceptional income. We've seen our debt purchase gross profit margin remain consistent at 75% year on year, together with a very slight softening in our 3PC gross profit margin, which softened from 46% in the prior year to 45% in the current. And that performance and those margins see the Extant Group's gross profit increase broadly in line with our cash income, being up some 21% to £410 million. If I turn to slide 11, and the growth in cash income and gross profit translates very well to earnings growth, with cash EBITDA and accounting EBITDA increasing by 18% and 17% respectively year on year. Now, EBITDA naturally stands lower than cash EBITDA, as under amortized cost accounting, effective interest rate accounting, we recognize a level yield over the life of our portfolio investments, whereas the cash EBITDA metric reflects the actual more front-loaded cash collections profile that we benefit from. We've also disclosed a waterfall at the bottom of the slide to aid transparency of the reconciliation between reported operating profits per the IFRS statutory accounts and the EBITDA and cash EBITDA numbers. So I take each of those three definitions, profitability in turn. The differences between operating profit and EBITDA include depreciation and amortization and those costs and income that we would classify as non-recurring and exceptional in nature as per the terms and indentures of the bond. The principal element of difference between EBITDA and cash EBITDA relates to portfolio write-up and portfolio amortization. Portfolio write-up represents both the mechanical inclusion each month of the next month's value in the tail, given our accounting is predicated upon both rolling curves and underlying changes in collections expectations, and it's a number of real substance. Portfolio write-up is something we've always recognised, and most importantly, have been able to demonstrate and prove to always be real. We've consistently outperformed the revised collection expectation post any upward revaluation. We define portfolio amortization as the difference between gross cash collection on assets owned and income from portfolio investments, or yield in other words. And for those of you on the call who wish to understand this in more detail, and I know there's a lot of you, we will be offering a refresher of what was a very popular accounting teaching session that we held last year, and we're going to provide further content as to our views on IFRS 9, IFRS 15, and also the forthcoming IFRS 16. And we'll issue a further update about this on our investor website in due course, knowing how many people will likely wish to attend. So with our cash metrics and income statement now covered, I'd like to turn to our balance sheet. Here, there's a twin dynamic of play on slide 12. Firstly, the deploying of capital in excess of our estimated remaining collections replacement rate is very apparent. We invested around 1.6 times our average replacement rate in 2017. Secondly, the other dynamic is that we consistently outperform our ERC forecasts. The combined effect of both dynamics is what is behind the increase, the 17% increase year on year in our ERC. And you can see that very clearly on slide 12. Now, such consistent overperformance gives confidence as to the robustness of both our ERC forecasts and, by default, the carrying value of portfolio investments on our statutory balance sheet. This closing balance on our balance sheet is a natural derivation from the ERC curve, being the cumulative value of each individual portfolio's gross ERC, discounted by the EIR, which is specific to that portfolio. Our ERC replacement rate for the ex-bank group at year-end was around 180 million, but I appreciate you'll be more interested in what the pro forma number is. So the pro forma group replacement rate is around £235 million. And with regards to that replacement rate, we're mindful that most bondholders and analysts understand the simplicity and also appreciate the transparency of the way in which we calculate the measure. Equally, however, we note that some of the more peripheral, more sceptical viewers of our industry have raised questions on the calculation, and we've subsequently seen some erroneous judgments reached to the level of gross money multiples that would need to be applied to free cash flow in order to keep reported ERC flat. As such, we've taken the liberty of including a specific disclosure in the appendix of our replacement rate calculation. Again, this can be something which we can cover off during any accounting teaching. More strategically, our overall portfolio acquisitions remain strong and well diversified across all the sectors that we cover. Our various forward flow arrangements and the wide sector spectrum of our client base enables us to deploy capital well above investment levels required to maintain ERC. We've never struggled to achieve significant investment for further growth, and we believe this will continue as the group benefits from an ever greater level of diversification following our acquisition of the carve-out business. So moving on to slide 13. and we've provided some more insight than we have previously as to the deployment of capital in 2017. We continue to make investment decisions for the long term, as demonstrated by the disciplined approach we apply when it comes to the pricing of new investments. We should also point out, when we're talking about gross money multiple changes, that they do not necessarily mean lower net returns, nor do they mean that competition has impacted returns. Changes in blended gross money multiples are more likely the impact of changes in purchase mix, with different asset classes have different risk-reward profiles. I'll come back to the slide. Over half of our portfolio acquisitions in 2017 have been into UK non-paying portfolios. Here is where our core expertise lies and where our data analytics capabilities provide us with a real competitive edge. With reference to the graph on the bottom left-hand side of the slide, this is a space where we're seeing limited pricing pressures given the consistency of the priced gross money multiples across vintages. At the same time, the value of our data insight, our collections effectiveness, our constant strive for innovation, I guess, is self-evident, with all three recent vintages showing healthy outperformance on a static basis versus our original price expectations. It's important to note that all the gross money multiples shown are on a like-for-like basis on this slide. So for the UK, we're comparing the original price gross money multiple on a 120-month basis versus the actual gross money multiple on the same 120-month basis, or a static basis, if you like. For DAC, it's the same dynamic, but with a timeline of 180 months. So we've also deployed a meaningful amount of capital into UK paying portfolios. Here we've got a comparatively lower gross money multiple, but this is offset by lower collection costs, lower risks, and it's these dynamics that mean we achieve net returns in line with our internal investment thresholds. Our blended gross money multiple for the Xtant Group in the last 24 months has been 2.2 times. It's stayed very stable. And for the same period for the pro forma group, would have been around 2.1 times. And again, it's stayed very stable over the most recent years. So I'll move on to slide 14. And let me set this context of this slide, and then I'll touch upon why it's a slide which we believe to be important to you guys as stakeholders. Each bar on the chart correlates to a specific stat approval date and shows the actual collections for the subsequent 12 months compared to the stat approval forecast for the same period. The percentages in the dotted boxes above show the actual collections out to December 2017 compared to the same stat approval date and forecast. Now, the chart demonstrates the prudence of our estimated remaining collection forecasts across a number of years and across varied economic times. The forecasts we've made throughout that period, underpinned by our data insight and capabilities, have proven marginally prudent in each case. We really like the transparency of this slide, and we've seen recent analyst reports also refer to that. For the first time, however, we've also provided further insight to the 2017 collections performance relative to the December 16 stat accrual. The table on the right-hand side breaks down the performance by vintage, or put more simply, by the age of our assets. This shows that the overall 107% performance that we achieved over the course of 2017 is not solely driven by just one or two specific vintages performing well, but it instead arises from achieving strong collections performance across all vintages, throughout the curve, throughout the tail, and this is key. It means that the value in the tail of our ERC curve is just as present, just as achievable, and just as real as it is for our more freshly acquired vintages. Now, such outperformance taken over a number of years and across different macroeconomic circumstances provides context as why we are not marking down our ERC estimates on adoption of IFRS 9. We're aware that others may reach a different judgment, so we would make two observations. Firstly, that the different debt purchasers have acquired different asset classes, and secondly, that the different debt purchasers have had different collection experiences during the economic downturns. All I can say is that our collection experience throughout the cycle bears testimony to how we deploy capital and how we apply data insight and process innovation to deliver a track record of ongoing outperformance against our collections estimates. So I move on to slide 15. And across the following two slides, I'd like to provide further greater insight into the Xtant Group's cost to collect performance, as again, I appreciate this has been a hot topic of debate. Before delving into the detail, slide 15 once again sets appropriate context. As we laid out earlier, over 70% of our portfolio acquisitions in 2017 have been into UK non-paying and DAC portfolios. The accumulation of both our 2017 purchase activity and our historic purchasing success results in over 80% of our 120-month ERC emanating from UK non-paying and DAC portfolios. Now, such portfolios are defined by characteristics which lead to a comparatively higher expense to service. They tend to be of a lower average balance, which gives rise to a lower recoverable amount for similar effort. The debt itself tends to be older, leading to more complex trace requirements. And given we're talking about non-paying debt, quite naturally there's a greater degree of engagement activities that are required to actually generate future collections. As such, an appreciation of these drivers of the cost to collect ratio is absolutely key to our knowledge, especially if one was to run a cost to collect comparison across the peer group. You know, stepping back, our overall cost to collect ratio should be way higher than our peer group, given our asset classes are so different. The reality, however, is that it's not. Now, with that context clearly outlined, let me turn to slide 16. And on a variable cost basis, our lifetime cost ratio, defined as cost to collect as a percentage of collections over a 120-month period, is typically between 17 to 20% for UK non-paying portfolios. The ratio also includes costs related to litigation, as you would expect. It includes all the variable costs. On UK paying portfolios, we typically see a lifetime cost ratio of less than 10%. Given the underlying characteristics of the accounts underpinning these portfolios, the variable cost curve remains broadly flat over the life of a portfolio. For the DAC region, we typically have a lifetime variable cost ratio of around 25 to 30%, and that reflects the differences in collection approaches across the markets between the regions. As in DAC, the collections process sees greater use of the courts to secure what is a 30-year legal title over amounts which are outstanding. Now, the variable percentages shown are indicative cost ratios based on the actual performance of historic vintages. As such, we believe that our future cost to collect ratios are likely to be lower than reported for two reasons. Firstly, we believe we'll leverage our enhanced scale. Secondly, we will seek to continue to innovate, to harness cost-effective channel migration, to utilise new technologies associated with robotics and AI, and to further leverage the benefits of our data insight. In addition, we continue to see more and more portfolios render low cost collections beyond 120 months, something that will only increase as our portfolios grow and our business ages. Our use of the term variable cost is closely aligned with collection activity costs, as reported on the face of the income statement. The more observant amongst you may also notice that we've restated this cost line within the consolidated financial statements to include the staff costs of those employees directly involved with collection activities. These costs have come out of other expenses historically and gone into collection activity costs in the current year, and clearly we changed the prior year comparative as well. And the reason why we've done this is to improve consistency and understanding across our financial statements and our broader reporting. As an important corollary to this, we provide an illustrative view of the typical shape of the lifetime variable cost to collect curve for UK non-paying portfolios, given that such portfolios account for the lion's share of the Xtant Group's 120-month ERC. The chart at the bottom of the slide demonstrates the front-loaded nature of variable costs for such portfolios. More intense collection activity occurs at the beginning of a portfolio's life, as we first onboard the accounts, trace the customers, contact them and ultimately look to engage with them to understand their specific and unique financial circumstances. For a typical non-paying portfolio, this initial onboarding and customer engagement stage tends to cover the first 6 months or so of the portfolio's life, the overall timeline being dependent upon the overall size of the portfolio acquired and, of course, the ever-important number of accounts that are being purchased. Post this stage, the variable cost to collect ratio quickly declines as portfolios begin to liquidate and costs begin to fall. and we hope that such insight gives a greater appreciation of how cost to collect naturally declines over time as a portfolio matures. We're mindful that the inherent net value of our back book is a critical element when investors and analysts look to calculate steady state asset coverage across our bonds. As such, when calculating the net value of the back book, we'd like to make 2 points. Firstly, the composition of our ERC by vintage, or in other words, asset age, needs to be taken into account. So let me try and use a specific example to provide context for this. If you take, say, the 2015 vintage for the extant group, on slide 30, we've got a very detailed split of ERC by vintage by age. And if you look on slide 30, you see this 2015 vintage is forecast to yield 120-month gross ERC of some $339 million, with $74 million expected to be collected over the next 12 months, $57 million the 12 months following that, so on and so forth. Now, as this vintage is now around 3 years old, we would expect it to incur a variable cost broadly in line with the year 3 point on the chart which you see in front of you. As for all intents and purposes, this vintage is now fully moved through the peak time of cost and the activity of onboarding and the initial customer engagement stage. So this is the indicative cost to collect ratio that should therefore be applied to the next 12 months forecast collections of $74 million. Rolling this forward, the year 4 point should then be applied to the $57 million of collections, and so on and so forth, and a similar approach should be applied to all other vintages. Doing this gives you an accurate view as to the cost to collect, and it's a key dynamic to be aware of, given that over 40% of the extant group's ERC is from portfolios that are owned for a year or less. Secondly, it should be recognised that there's meaningful value in the tail beyond 120 months. We continue to benefit from collections on vintages that are now well over 10 years old. In addition to this, the marginal gross profit contribution from these older vintages is highly accretive. We direct you to think that the variable cost to collect ratio beyond year 10 continues to decline to around the mid to low single digits. It becomes an annuity stream. Finally, myself and my team are very aware that downside modelling sometimes requires runoff analysis to be undertaken, even if that is not something that we contemplate within the business. Now, under such a hypothetical view, the aforementioned analysis would need to account for further significantly reduced costs as overheads would swiftly run down, while the absence of any new portfolios being onboarded would see variable costs and headcount fall. Let me just pause at this point and ask people to move to section 3 of the presentation. So section 3 of the presentation is intended to provide insight to our newly combined pro forma group following the acquisition of the carve-out business from Intrum. So let me start with slide 18 and just talk about what our year-end leverage is post that completion. So our pro forma leverage as of December 2017, as measured by net debt to last 12-month cash EBITDA, stands at 5.2 times, same number that we came to the market when we looked to raise the bond with. Now, given the feedback from some in the market as to the capital structure of the carve-out acquisition, again, I think it's important to provide some context here. Leverage is flat to September 2017. This is despite deploying in excess of £150 million of capital in the final 3 months of 2017 on a pro forma basis. This level of investment has had a small impact on our net debt position, but without any immediate positive upside to cash EBITDA. These are newly acquired portfolios, and as such, they're yet to start to contribute any meaningful incremental cash flows. And there's 2 points to therefore note. First is that the business generates excess cash to help fund new purchases. Not all purchases are 100% debt funded. The second is that while leverage management's important to us, so too is deploying capital at attractive rates of return in order to achieve EBITDA growth and medium-term deleveraging. Consequently, while we've committed to a medium-term leverage guide, we'll also point out that we've seen continued purchase success in Q1 2018. As such, we remain mindful that purchasing success, whilst right for the business in the medium to long term, carries with it the same timing dynamic as I've just outlined in terms of year-end in Q4. As such, we'd like to guide thinking to a minimal change in our leverage position during Q1 and through to the first half of 2018. Over the medium term, It's the quantum of portfolio acquisitions that will provide stimulus to both cash collections and cash EBITDA. And it's through continually growing our cash EBITDA, together with the confidence that we have in the underlying cash generative nature of our business, that allows us to reiterate our medium-term net debt leverage guidance of below 4.5 times. Now, making a comment as to our leverage and purchasing success in the final few months of 2017 provides a natural segue to slide 19 and the illustrative free cash flow generation of the pro forma group. This is a view that's now very familiar to a number of you. As previously shared, there's a few key points I'd like to once again draw out. Firstly, when looking at the starting point of any illustrative cash flow analysis, one needs to account for the lag nature of that cash EBITDA metric, as it takes those 6 months before purchase assets throw off significant monthly cash flow. This is obviously a critical aspect to note, given the level and timing of purchases that I've just alluded to. Even more so, I guess, given the purchase success in the final quarter of 17. You can see that purchase success clearly demonstrated by the chart on the top left-hand side of the slide. Similarly, although not underpinned by a capital investment, some recently enacted 3PC relationships will also take time to reach maturity and generate incremental cash flows. And as such, it's important to account for a natural step up in our business as a result of those recent purchases and recent 3PC wins. And related to this, those recent purchases also drive a step up in our estimate of the replacement rate, as we will naturally see collections roll in from these acquisitions over the next 12 months. This is key yet related point, makes it even more critical for people to appreciate the natural step up in cash EBITDA from recently acquired portfolios. The last point to make around free cash flow, and setting aside timing, is that the expected growth in our free cash flow can be rationalised by the purchases in excess of our replacement rate, contributing to the ongoing growth of the business, as demonstrated by the 7% increase in our pro forma ERC in one quarter alone. Given we've deployed around $100 million of investment capital for growth in the last 12 months, and a similar excess amount when considering just the fourth quarter of 2017 in isolation, these purchases will start to generate ever greater collections and ever greater cash EBITDA over the medium term. Moving to slide 20, our pro forma 120-month ERC now stands at $2.8 billion. It's also important to reiterate the upfront nature of our ERC curve. We now expect to collect in excess of £1 billion over the next 24 months alone. We favour a front-loaded collections profile. We accept it leads us to a higher replacement rate requirement, but it provides us with greater visibility of our future cash flow generation. I've alluded to the amount of collections that we expect to achieve beyond 120 months. And you can see that there's an additional $0.5 billion, or £454 million to be precise, which we expect to collect between years 11 and 15. Slide 21 nicely captures how our regional positions of scale and market leadership provide both scope for growth and underpin the strength of the group's diversification. Let me touch upon the regional year-on-year performance as shown on the left-hand side of the slide in a little more detail. The UK recorded an increase in both cash collections and revenue, following both higher portfolio investments and strong performance relative to ERC forecasts of our existing portfolio investments. This has led to pleasing growth in both cash EBITDA and ERC. We also saw a positive movement in UK margins as we start to leverage the scale of the platform in this particular region. Whilst we recorded modest growth in cash EBITDA in the DACH region, the overall results need to be seen in the context of a year of consolidation and investment. While DACH collection activity costs have improved, that's definitely helped gross profit margins. We did see an increase in other expenses. Some of those are one-off in nature as a result of bringing together the activities and platforms of wanting to affect three different businesses of GFKL, Kesh and IS and Castle for the first time for a full 12-month period. And we believe that the investments that we've made in that region will allow us to achieve further growth and further margin development. We've also provided insight to the year-on-year development of the Nordic region. Pleasingly, the region has delivered strong growth in both cash EBITDA and ERC, with the full year 2017 outturn and keeping with our underwriting assumptions. We'd also draw attention to the scale of the pro forma business. with cash income for the group amounting to more than £800 million for 2017 and pro forma portfolio acquisitions close to £400 million. So from a group perspective, together with the Nordic region, our 120-month ERC shows a more balanced regional split, with the UK accounting for 57% of the total, the Nordic region representing 26%, and the DACH region representing some 16% of our total group.
Thank you, Colin. Let me give you a break for a minute. Moving on to slide 22. Given the transformational nature of our acquisition and the carve-out business, I think it's appropriate to take some time to reiterate our strategic rationale for the transaction and how the group is positioned for future success. We now have a leading presence in the three largest, most sophisticated, best-regulated consumer credit markets in Europe. The majority of these markets does not equate to a position of no growth. In fact, it is quite the opposite, with consumer credit forecasts to continue to grow at healthy levels. Together with our positions of scale and leadership based on long-standing client relationships across our group, we are well placed to benefit from these significant opportunities for robust levels of profitable growth. Our scale and diversification also provides us with greater scope to continue to deploy capital in a considered manner and where returns are highest. We benefit from increased geographic, product, client, and originating sector diversification. The group is not beholden to any one region, underlying asset type or sector to deliver profitable growth. In addition, the share of our capital-light 3PC and value-add services businesses now accounts for around 24% of pro forma cash income, further establishing this business line as an integral offering to our clients, as well as an element of diversification and source of value creation. Looking back to when we announced the transaction, and with hindsight, I think we could have done a better job explaining the synergies from bringing the businesses together. We know there are client relationships in all the regions that we can build upon that will allow for further debt purchase and servicing opportunities. We equally know there are great opportunities for best practice sharing. And one area that essentially and especially attracted us to the carve-out business was their use of innovation, something we believe we can leverage to deliver benefits across greater efficiency and collections effectiveness across the group. And finally, we also believe there are meaningful opportunities to use our enhanced scale to secure cost savings in, for example, procurement of IT services. Let me close this section on our integration approach on slide 23. Our preparation for the integration has been in place for a number of months now, and our approach benefits from applying the previous experiences and learnings from when we brought Lowell and GF Gale together. Our integration efforts are led by a specific project team, together with executive sponsor support from Colin and, of course, myself. As Colin mentioned earlier, and to reiterate, we have identified three key areas of value creation. One, grow the combined business through the leveraging of cross-regional clients' relationships and best practice sharing to align our approach to pricing, as an example. Two, improve our net collections through the sharing of operational best practices to increase collections efficiency. And thirdly, explore areas where the enlarged group can benefit from economies of scale. Moving to slide 25. In terms of the outlook for the group, let me start with our perspective on the overall market. We continue to believe that our market benefits from a number of encouraging external growth factors, which specifically support our main strategic focus upon unsecured, non-performing consumer debt. The macroeconomic outlook across all our regions has led to increased levels of unsecured consumer credit. In our largest market, the UK, we have seen outstanding total unsecured debt reach levels of pre-financial crisis peak with more than £200 billion outstanding. Looking forward, the consensus is that we will continue to see sustained moderate growth in unsecured consumer credit across all our regions, in turn supporting an ongoing healthy flow of new debt coming to the market. Our view is the fears of the UK downturn may prove to be somewhat exaggerated or overstated, and whilst we would agree that UK growth may prove slower in comparison to, say, the euro area or pre-Brexit forecasts, the consensus view is that the UK economy will continue to grow. Should we see a macroeconomic downturn in any of our markets, however, it's worth reflecting that whilst levels of consumer lending may fall, we would expect increased delinquency rates and thus more debt reaches non-performing stage. This obviously provides us with further opportunities in terms of both servicing and purchase. Outside of macroeconomic thinking and unsecured debt growth rates, our prospects are further enhanced by being one of the few CMS businesses that purchase and service debt across the originating spectrum. The implementation of IFRS 9, alongside recent guidance from both the ECB and European Commission on NPLs, we believe will stimulate the quantum of FS debt coming to the market. Structural changes in retail with the wider use of consumer finance from non-mainstream financial institutions, we believe, will also stimulate non-FS supply as well. So, as you can hear, we remain very bullish and confident about the opportunities across our marketplaces. Moving to slide 26, let me elaborate on a couple of points. Focusing internally, the strong momentum we saw last year has continued in the first months of 2018. In addition, the trading performance of the carve-out business has been overall in line with underwriting, with 2017 full-year purchasing activity actually ahead of expectations. Looking externally, we are better prepared than ever to weather any fluctuations in any individual market as a result of our enhanced European scale and reach, whilst our IFRS 9 preparatory work provides further evidence of the underlying resilience of the business model and our strong track record of weathering positive and even more recessionary economic cycles. In terms of investment flow, we already have line of sight of some £200 million of committed purchases in 2018, further supplemented by a pipeline of forward flow purchases in excess of £150 million on a cumulative basis out to 2021. As such, we have great visibility of the year ahead and beyond, underpinned by what will remain core to us, a disciplined, long-term approach to pricing and investment. And so we reach the end of our formal presentation. We hope that both our materials and our voiceover has provided a greater understanding of our business than ever before. And of course, whilst I'm extremely biased, I believe this is a great business and one that we're extremely proud to both lead and represent. Colin started today's call by explaining there were three things we'd like you to take away. So just to reiterate, the business has gone through very complex transformation over the past years. And once again, we're extremely proud to be stood here saying we've delivered another strong set of results with impressive growth. Our acquisition of the Intrum carve-out represents a pivotal moment in our corporate timeline. And we really look forward to 2018 and beyond with great positivity and enthusiasm and excitement as to our prospects. And with that, we'd like to thank you all for listening, and I'd like the operator to open up for any questions you may have.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, please press star 2, and you will be advised when to ask your question. Okay, so our first question comes in from the line of Tom Gibney. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the questions. Just with respect to the portfolio purchases this year, obviously the first half is going to be very, very busy. Would you expect that to slow a little bit in the second half as you digest those first half acquisitions? And then just on that slide with respect to outperforming the ERC estimates, what types of portfolio outperformed and where what was really leading to that outperformance in 2017? And then thirdly, with DACA, you mentioned that there are a number of one-off costs and investments that you've undertaken last year. How should we think about that going forward? Can you provide any sort of quantitative guidance in that sense? And then just lastly, I just wondered whether you could give us or say something about your attitude to further M&A, perhaps through bolt-ons or other markets that you might want to go into.
Thanks, Tom. I think in those raft of questions, you've covered off every topic which we could have asked for. So thank you for that. It allows for a good response. Maybe if we just divide and conquer on a few of them. I think in terms of purchase momentum, we have seen a strong start to the year. I think I'd guide people to thinking that while we're still closing down the Q1 numbers, you know, an expectation of around 70 million worth of purchases in sterling is probably not an unreasonable number to think about. Whether that continues throughout the year remains to be seen. I think clearly we are very mindful of both leverage but also the need to continue to grow the business when there's attractive investment opportunities which satisfy our internal return thresholds. In terms of the ERC point, we have seen outperformance in 2017 across the board. There is no specific segment which has shone relative to others. We've seen outperformance in terms of FS, retail and telco. And why we think we've done that, I directly once again to just think about the constant innovation which we've alluded to previously. It's based upon data insight and it's also based upon diversity. I think the fact that we purchase accounts from not just FS, but across the board obviously gives us additional data reach and data advantage, which obviously helps us to hone our collection efforts to the most appropriate accounts with the highest propensity to pay. You quite rightly mentioned the one-off costs that I made reference to. I direct you to think that in the DAC region, there's around 10 million worth of non-recurring costs associated with bringing our platforms together. You know, we're in the process of trying to consolidate and rationalize platforms. And we've also had some limited site consolidation as well. So that would be the number which I would encourage you to think about. And then in terms of M&A appetite?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we've got a lot to consolidate in terms of what we're focusing on right now. Clearly, the Nordic transaction, we are very determined and keen to get off to a good start, as we have done already. And therefore, you know, that's clearly got a lot of our focus and attention. I don't expect us to be changing that focus for some time.
Great. Thanks very much.
The next question comes in from the line of Ben Durrington. Please go ahead.
Hi. With the ERC-driven carve-outs in the bond documents for the secured leverage test, it looks like the carve-outs are now bigger than the 230 million unsecured bond. I just wondered if that the maths was right on that, because the ERC has grown so much over the last year.
That's not a calculation which we've looked at. We'll have to take that away and respond probably to you and ask you one call.
Okay, and then, sorry, follow-up question. If you did, I noted the comments with CDS widening at the start of the call, but are you aware that if you did move to an all-secured cap structure like many of your peers, that sometime after the first call in November for the unsecured bonds, that would effectively lead to no deliverables on the CDS?
Yeah, that's not for us to comment on the CDS. You know, I'm very focused upon making sure that our cap structure satisfies our internal objectives.
And do you have any view on, like, eventually moving to a secured capital structure?
I think that we're mindful of how our evolution could well be as the business grows in maturity. But other than that, there's nothing which I'd like to add at this stage.
Okay, thanks very much. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
The next question comes in from the line of Karen Miles. Please go ahead.
Hi, James. Colin, good morning. Sort of following off of some of Tom's comments, but also just looking at slide 21, I think we all appreciate the added disclosure by geography. What I can see, I think, in the UK is that your cash margin improved probably 100 basis points year on year. I think it was probably 61% last year, 62% this year, which is a nice trend. Can you just talk a little bit more about what is you know, what's driving that improvement, and how do you see the margin evolving through 2018? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll pick up that. So, you know, not surprisingly, if you look at our sort of transformation or change projects that we've got ongoing, there's a large proportion of those that focus around how we clearly can leverage our scale. Obviously, there's a lot around sort of consolidation of our platforms in terms of looking at our target operating model, and we sort of alluded to, you know, even with the Nordic transaction, there's some great opportunities for us to be able to look at industrializing our infrastructure, for example, even more so than we have. So I think it's fair to say that we will expect to see us focusing on improving our margins and optimizing our target operating model for some time yet. and there's plenty in the pipeline of opportunities for us to be able to do that. In terms of you know, deliverables on that and sort of when you would expect to see those materializing, I think this will just be a, I guess, a drip feeding of improvements, you know, on a continued basis for some time. So, and you know, like you've seen this year, I would imagine we will be able to replicate similar advantages as we continue.
Great, thank you.
The next question comes in from the line of Roberto Enriquez. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my question. I guess my main question was really with regard to the strategic thinking around the carve-out, and I appreciate the comments in terms of, you know, earnings diversification and overall geographical diversification, but I guess the fact of the matter is that in acquiring that carve-out, I mean, it's very difficult to actually see very obvious cost or revenue synergies. I mean, there's obviously no overlap in operations, data set. You're still going to be competing against, I guess, a very large player in the form of Intrum, and those markets seem to be, you know, fairly mature. So I just wanted to know, in terms of, you know, where Lowell is today with regard to overall leverage, how much of a contribution could we expect, you know, the carve-out to make towards meeting that 4.5% medium-term leverage target? Because I guess failing that, the only other alternative, which I gather from the presentation, the other lever that you have is really with regard to purchase success. And obviously, you know, to the extent that there are always going to be those opportunities out there, it's very difficult to see how you could potentially de-lever otherwise.
So I think that as we iterated earlier, I think there are some very strong strategic rationale for the Nordic transaction in terms of how it complements our existing strategy. As we said, we actually like operating within reasonably mature and sophisticated markets. We actually think that's critical to our success factors, particularly around sort of the regulatory environments and the data environments for which the Nordics are renowned for being very forward-thinking on. I think it's fair to say that there will be some cost efficiencies, despite the fact that there are clearly aren't overlaping operating platforms for us to dedupe against. So, you know, one I've alluded to before is, for instance, just industrializing our IT services you know, with larger industrialized players and being able to actually drive down unit costs for hosting, for example. You know, that in itself is, you know, will yield several million benefits per annum. So just as one example. So, you know, we're very confident that we will be able to leverage cost efficiency. I think, you know, the other part clearly was the market ones. And, you know, given they are the three largest regions that we operate within, not surprisingly, there's a lot of our client base that operate within all three regions or across two of the regions. So the Nordics, again, is very complementary to that strategy. And we're already having some very exciting conversations at sea level with some of those clients today. So, like I said, I think from our perspective, there was a very good complementary fit and very strong reasons to think why this strategically will enhance the overall group. And I think, you know, just in terms of cross-fertilization of skill sets as well. So, yeah. You know, the UK's decision or some of the decision science things that we've done across the group in the UK and DAC will definitely complement our colleagues in the Nordics. We're very confident about that. And vice versa in terms of some of the things that the Nordic team have done, given their level of experience within their market as well. So, like I said, overall, feel very confident about the delivery of the ability to be able to leverage synergies.
And maybe, Roberto, if I just cover off your sort of ancillary point with regards to deleveraging guidance.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting way to look at it as to, you know, what proportionality of the deleveraging comes from which region. That's not something which I'm going to be able to cover off very simply. I think I'd probably step back and you say, you know, you make the observation that it's quite difficult to see where it might come from. Let me offer an alternative hypothesis. Given that we have pretty much self-funded most of the purchases in Q4, there was only a marginal uptick in debt from Q3 to Q4, let's just assume that our net debt remains largely static at that 2.1 billion for the rest of this year. That would require a cash EBITDA number of around $467 million in order to get the leverage down to 4.5. To get to a cash EBITDA for the pro forma of 467, to get to a pro forma cash EBITDA number of $467 million would mean we'd have to grow by around 16%. Now, that's in line with the growth rate that we delivered, not just in 2017, but also 2016. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility to direct people towards thinking in that manner.
Okay, very good. If I could just come in with another question. I mean, obviously you've highlighted that, you know, you've had a high degree of purchasing success through, you know, the course of 2017. I just wanted to know if you had identified, I guess, for the pro forma group as a whole, what you would expect a normalized purchasing run rate to be, and which would potentially, you know, obviously absent any, you know, abnormal growth and, you know, EBITDA expansion, where do you see that normalized purchasing run rate?
We're all nodding our heads around the table. That's a really good question and obviously very pertinent to people's modelling, so I understand the logic of asking it. I think, you know, the guidance, I'm not going to give a specific number. I'm very mindful of forward-looking statements, but having said that, if you look to the history of the past and the actual acquisition profiles within UK DAC and the Nordics, I think you'd be able to see a normalised purchasing range of typically around 1.5 to 2.2 times the replenishment rate. And that's probably where I'd guide you towards thinking. And I appreciate that that's a relatively large range, but obviously it's very difficult to say what purchase opportunities will come to the market in the next 12 months and equally whether they would satisfy our risk and our reward thresholds.
Very good. Thank you.
No, thank you.
The next question comes in from the line of Stephen Tapley. Please go ahead.
Hello. If we could just turn to slide 19. It's to the waterfall chart you have there. And it just appears that the replenishment rate has stepped up considerably since the January issuance. Just some colour around that, because my impression was from the Q4 numbers that there was some success in purchasing. So I'm wondering why it's requiring a considerable amount more to maintain that replenishment rate.
Yeah, good spot, good question, Stephen. There's nothing particularly alarming here. There's no change in gross money multiples or expectations with regards to cash collections. It's purely because of the success that we've had in purchases in the last quarter. You know, when you've got a growth in your ERC of 7% within one quarter, that's going to have a marked impact upon your replenishment rate as a consequence. And as I say, if I can direct you to start, you know, there's a few different replenishment rate numbers, but given it's a hot topic, I'm more than happy to spend a little bit of time on. I mean, we've included there the year-end number, and then equally within the appendix on slide 36, we've shown how we derive the year-end numbers, but then obviously you then take an average number in order to understand what the replenishment rate was during the course of the year. So obviously that kicks up because of that purchasing success with 163 million deployed in Q4.
Yeah, no, I do appreciate the difficulty between the year end and the average, and I assume average is taken because we're looking at historical EBITDA figures as well too, which would be
correct
for the last 12 months.
Correct.
I appreciate you compared the two, but that would have also been true, you know, for the pro forma Q3 numbers. So, you know, because if I look in one way, you know, net debt is up by 50 million, but your ERC is up by 150 million. So that's either, I initially assume that points to good purchasing in Q4, but potentially some upward value revaluation in the ERC. But I'm trying to square good purchasing in Q4 with, you know, a 20 million extra need or an 18 million extra need for the replenishment rate to go up. Because the two seem to be, when I'm missing the subtlety of it, seem to be at, in opposition.
Hi, Stephen. Apologies, Stephen, to talk over you. It's John Trott here, head of IR. I guess the way I would probably try to think about it, I think we had 194 million in the roadshow for the average replacement rates based off the Q3 17 numbers. We're now looking around about 212. What's that? Is that about 18 million?
Yeah.
That's kind of what, 7-8%? And that broadly ties in line with the 7% growth we've seen in the ERC. and that 7% growth in one quarter, and that's purely your dynamic that's driving that uptick. And you know, we acknowledge, and as we stated, that 402 is a lag number. It doesn't then bring in the benefit of that 163 million and some of the Q3 purchases as well. So there is a bit of a timing play that has taken place between the Q3 presentation and the Q4 presentation that you're seeing now.
Okay. And then, sorry, to follow on that gentleman's point on deleveraging, again, if you have minimal change in H1, and it looks like the excess cash flow in the steady state basis looks skinny enough, can you talk about the source of deleveraging? Is it ultimately going to be from economies of scale? And then ultimately, can you put some timeline around that 4.5 times in any kind of way?
Yeah, so we're definitely going to benefit from economies of scale. You've partially answered the question with that, but clearly we've got the EBITDA growth, which is going to be the principal driver of the deleveraging. And as John says, we've included a trailing measure on the waterfall, which you see on the slide, which is obviously not reflecting all of the cash collections, cash EBITDA, which comes from, you know, what is it? It's around 200 million worth of, over 220 million worth of acquisitions for the second half of 2017. And that's going to provide significant impetus. I think in terms of timeline, which is obviously a different question, we've always said that it's a medium-term time frame. When we first announced that guidance, it was obviously prior to the carve-out acquisition. When we think about medium-term, we're typically thinking of under 2 years.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you. Operator, I guess we've probably reached the end of the hour. I know I may be in danger of upsetting one or two people who would like to ask a couple of questions, but my suggestion would be, just given the time which we've got and other pressing demands upon us, we should probably draw this to a close at this juncture. And with that, I just have one small housekeeping point that I'd like to make. With regards to the unaudited pro forma income statement in the appendix, and it is not part of the audited GH2 accounts, just while we've been talking, we've just noted a very small clerical error with regards to the numbers below the operating profit line. As such, we're going to issue an addendum, redrafted set of numbers. We're going to upload that to the website very shortly. I'm pretty sure it won't change how you feel about the overall presentation, which over the course of today, we're very pleased to have represented. And very pleased to have had the chance to engage with you as well. So thanks once again for your time, thanks once again for your interest, and more importantly, thanks once again for the ongoing support for what's a great business.
Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's call. You may now disconnect your handsets.